Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This is Lamar with 5280 Esports. I am here today with a very special guest. It goes by Dre or Andreas.
Yeah, either.
Okay, so we got Dre, and he is actually the CEO creative director of Nosebleed Interactive, who actually develops one of the coolest games that I played recently, which is why I'm excited to have him. But go ahead and let us know kind of a little bit about yourself, Dre.
Yeah, sure thing. I'm Dre Spernagle, or Dre, creative director and CEO of Nosebleed Interactive. Been making games professionally for 23 years or something mad like that. That seems wrong. That seems incorrect. But yeah, first game I ever worked on was as a tester on a game called Big Mother Truckers on GameCube. That was my first credited title. There's not the high point on my career, but also not the low point. That was Big Mother Truckers 2, Truck Me Harder.
I may have heard about that game, actually.
Yeah. BMT wasn't bad. BMT 2 was really, really bad. It was like pulling teeth working on that. I'm a big gamer. Nosebleed itself has been going for coming up for 13 years, I think. No, 12. It's 12 years in May officially, but I'd kind of already started it 12 years ago. I guess our biggest and most well-known title is Arcade Paradise. I mean, it shipped on basically every platform, including Google Stadia. Shipped. In fact, it launched the day that they closed that server. Well, no, the day that they announced that they were closing the service, which is disappointing. But obviously it's been on Game Pass and Humble Choice most recently. That's me.
Well, thank you so much for hopping on. I know it's been a little bit I guess you'd say journey to get here. we've been in talk for a while.
I'm not very organized. I'm not very organized. That's the problem. It's not on you. That's definitely on me.
no problem. I just want to say new happy New Year's to everyone. I know it's kind of the holidays, so we didn't have too many episodes coming out, but we're back in it. Season 2 for 24. We're super excited. We have a really good list of people coming out to be on the show. We have some really good guests for everyone. So Dre, like I said, so you're the CEO and creative director of Nosebleed Interactive. For everyone listening, I kind of wanted to get an idea of like kind of your backstory, kind of how you, did you start the company? Did you get into it? Was it already established? Kind of going to the business of it and in your background, kind of your personal life growing up, stuff like
that. Yeah, sure thing.
I really appreciate you hopping on here. I said, thank you so much. And I guess we can get started whenever you're ready.
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, so I first thing I'll say is I'm a big, big gamer, and I have been since I played on the VIC-20. the first time I sort of touched on, always wanted to make games since the age of 8. Draw maps and stuff like that draw screens for puzzle games that I used to love and that sort of thing. I got my, as I say, worked on my first game kind of 23 years ago. As a tester for a company and worked for them mostly on racing games for about 3-4 years, and then took a bit of a sabbatical as my wife was doing a PhD and sort of travelled the world for a year. Yeah. And then got a job up in Scotland at a company where I quickly kind of went into from testing into kind of design, and was a sort of level designer and game designer there for about 6 years working on kind of third-party games for Sony stuff. So we did like a bunch of the Buzz Junior games, which I don't know if you remember them. It was like the quiz games, but the kids versions, which use controllers. And then we did a PlayStation Move launch title called The Shoot, which was really good learning experience and really fun to work on. The game itself, like, has a lot of flaws, but it's one of those ones that I have quite a lot of fond memories of because of just, you know, it's got lots of good parts, but overall it's not great. And then the company that I was working for ceased trading maybe 13, 14 years ago. So basically everyone got made redundant, studio effectively closed. And so I decided to set up my own company, basically. So kind of with some credit cards and not that many contacts and a bit of redundancy pay, I sort of started out, got a few graduates, recent graduates from local universities, and paired them off with some kind of veterans, like a guy who had worked on the Large Hadron Collider and then worked on the Watch Dogs renderer team for Ubisoft.
Oh, cool.
Kind of paired, and an artist from Sega Racing Studios, kind of paired one graduate with one, you know, senior, one graduate with one senior. And the seniors were kind of doing 2 days a week or something like that. So it wasn't breaking the bank, let's say.
Yeah.
and I think they set out to do their own thing as well. And built a prototype, built our own engine for PlayStation Mobile. I don't know if you remember that as a platform. It was a thing that was available on Android and on PlayStation Vita early doors. And so I had some contacts from Sony still, just a little bit. I mean, I had no business experience, but I kind of knew the people that I'd worked with in the past. Reached out to them and they were like, oh, I'll pitch it to us. So my first ever pitch to anyone was five Sony execs and one guy from Creative UK, who's like a government organization that help fund stuff. And I'd seen a bunch, and they'd kind of done a bunch of like, it was kind of like a slight kind of competition pitching event type thing where they would fund a prototype for the winners. I got super drunk the night before. I was wearing a suit with like shirt and tie. I'd never pitched to anyone before because I was like, yeah, that's probably what people do. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd worked in games for 12 years or something previously, or 10 years previously, but I hadn't, you know, I was just doing day-to-day work. I'd never done any of the biz dev side of things. So I turned up really hungover in a suit, sweating, sat down on the end of a table, like one of those nightmare interviews, on the table on one end, six people on the end, five Sony execs on one side, and started explaining the game. Pulled out of my jacket pocket a PlayStation Vita running the game, but running it a prototype, handed it over, and I knew it was going well when one of the execs was like, oh no, just one more go. I was like, okay, this is going okay, this isn't bad. And so, yeah, they basically pretty much on the spot signed the game, which is great. But then we spent 2.5 years kind of making it. So that was a game called The Hungry Horde, and it was a PlayStation Vita exclusive. Published by Sony.
So was that your first kind of big indie game that you got into the...
Yeah, that was the first game. Yeah, that was the first game that we as a studio did, Nosebleed Interactive. The first game that was like me as a creative director and you know, calling pretty much all the shots, that sort of thing. You know, previously I'd been a lead designer at a studio of like 50, 60 people, but this was the first time kind of doing it off my own back, let's say. Obviously with a really great team leading that back. You know, I say lead. They lead me. That's the thing. Surround yourself with other people.
Gotcha. So did you go to school then to be like, did you have to go to school to get into that? Or what was your kind of schooling like? What did you plan on doing?
So I finished school and went to, I guess you call it, school is like before university type thing. Sure, so we call it uni here, I suppose. But so I didn't really know what I was doing when I was like 17, 18. So I went to, I picked a city that might be quite cool and a bit of a party place. And I speak German fluently. So I was like, I'll do German and politics. Well, German and business studies. But I actually got the form wrong and it ended up being German and politics. So, you know, that tells you something, how motivated I was to do that.
Yeah.
And I dropped out after like 3 months. I was like, this is, why am I doing this? This is a massive waste of time and money. And like, so I kind of went back to the drawing board and I kind of at the time was really, I mean, I was still playing loads of games, but I was like, you didn't really consider a career in games to be a viable thing. I was kind of like TV and film, like film editing, that sort of stuff I was really into. So I did a sort of media production degree, but like in the, within the first year of doing that, I was really playing loads more games and like starting to kind of understand a little bit how they were built and kind of, you know, getting into the kind of being interested in the industry and that sort of stuff. So my media degree, I kind of tailored a little bit, you know, so when people were like, oh, we'll do an interview with the local, you know, we had to do like a, one of the practical modules was like a, you know, shoot a documentary. And some of the people were like, oh, we'll go and interview firemen at the local fire station. And I was like, yeah, am I allowed to swear? Am I good swearing?
Yeah, I was like, sure, you can swear.
Fuck that. I'm going to get in the car and drive to like, Free Radical they just done to interview David Doak, who's like Dr. Doak in the GoldenEye games, and they just launched, well, they launched Time Splitters 1 on PS2 maybe 6 months earlier. Got down there and they were like, yeah, did a really good interview with him, and they were like, oh, do you want to have a go on Time Splitters 2, the demo, where we're up to. I was like, yes, please, about a year before it would come out. Edge magazine over here in the UK is like a print video games magazine, one of the few that's still printed, and it's like sort of the one that's got a bit of an industry focus, you know, it's the respected one. So I went down to interview them and they just got their first Xbox like 3 days earlier and Halo, and they were like, it was one of their famous like 10 out of 10, you know, they don't give a lot of 10s, and they were like, yeah, this is really good. Do you want to have a go on it? So basically that was kind of where I was at. And then graduating, I was a bit like, well, I want to work in games either as a TV film kind of editing or games, but my motivation for games was a lot stronger. So I basically just started applying for jobs and actually got the first one as a tester. I was like, in where I live, there's like a Ubisoft studio, Reflections, who did like Driver and Stuntman and a bunch of stuff. And I really wanted to work there, but I was a bit like, oh, I'm not going to apply there yet because I'm going to I'm going to apply to this place and use the feedback from my application. And I got the first job that I applied for. So it's like, all right, fair enough.
And you said that job was a, what was that job?
It was as a tester at, or a QA at.
Quality assurance testing.
Yeah. At Utechnics. So they were like, they had the NASCAR license for years and years. So that's probably what they're most well known for. But I worked on Big Mother Truckers 2, Truck Me Harder, SRS Street Racing Syndicate, Ford Mustang, The Legend Lives. And I think that was it. Maybe, I think I might have seen the first like couple of months of work on, what was it? Pimp My Ride, I think. Yeah. That didn't review very well, I don't think. I'd left by the time that was in the full production.
Yeah. So you're in you had a few jobs in the industry. You got that QA. What did you do after that? Did you kind of move up into different positions?
Or? Yeah. So at Utechnics, I didn't. At Utechnics, I mean, I was there for like two, three years. But then moved to Scotland, became a lead tester, and then kind of travelled around the world a little bit for 8 months, like just a bit of kind of backpacker for me. Well, I was a backpacker, but. Was kind of doing.
Cool, because I've seen those a lot of those openings, and for people wondering, you know, what is a Q&A tester? What do you do? You be a game tester, right? You play the games, look for bugs, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it really depends on who you're working for, but as an internal tester for a developer, I think there's probably a bit more of a difference between an internal QA and like working for a QA house or like a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working for a developer, you're a lot closer to the game. So it's actually a brilliant way of kind of learning the industry because you're constantly communicating with the design team, the art team, the coders. You know, I remember sitting, you know, there'd be a bug that I found, some sort of crash bug, and the coders would be like, right, can you sit up next to me? I'll watch you play. You try and get it to crash. I'll, you know, debug it. And I'd be watching them putting breakpoints into their code. And like, wow. You get a lot more familiar with how the game is built within a sort of QA team for a developer. Now, I think the other thing that's probably a common misconception is, you know, you're just sitting playing the game. I mean, that is 90% of your job, mm-hmm. but you're not playing it for fun. You're playing it to try and break it and to try and break it in ways that you can always repeat. Mm-hmm. And if you're creative, it's not the easiest job because effectively you're just ruining other people's work. You're just like, yeah. Right, how can, so, you know, it can be quite demotivating, let's say. But it is, yeah. It's an absolutely brilliant way of kind of learning that sort of communication skill and stuff like that. I still think QA are massively undervalued by sort of developers and publishers. They're, you know, they're such an integral part of game development that it's kind of unreal.
That sounds like a good way to get kind of in the industry, because like you said, even there's a lot of developers and companies looking for Q&As, and like you said, I think they are undervalued, but it sounds like it's a great way to really get head first into the industry and learn different aspects of it, at least kind of touch on different aspects of game development.
One of our sort of superstar coders, she started as QA, had no code, practical code experience at all, and kind of on the job she is really technically minded, and she was probably the best tester I've ever worked with. We could really find stuff easily, but also could normally, you know, had an idea of why things were breaking, which is, I think, a really good sign. You know, this breaks, that's not really that useful to anyone. This breaks if you do this. This has like a 90% chance of breaking if you do this. That's really useful. This breaks 100% of the time. I think it might be because of this, this, and this. That's like, that's when you know you've got someone who's really good at kind of testing and QA. And so I started giving her kind of some more technical jobs, like sort of some junior design jobs. And in Arcade Paradise, you know, she started off doing a few of the simpler games, and then she actually did Blockchain, which is by far my favorite in the game. And she wrote that from scratch. It's like, well, hang on, you're not a designer really anymore at all. You're a coder. And since then, she's kind of moved fully into code, and it's all completely on the job, self-taught. And she's, she's proper. Yeah, she's very good.
Hey, Brandy, thanks for following. Are we new on streaming? No, the show is kind of new. It's maybe 6 months old. We've had a lot of cool guests on here. But no, we've been streaming for a while. We've had a lot of cool interviews. If you want to check out the rest, all of our platforms or on all the streaming services, it's just 5280 Esports. Got a ton of cool interviews. so you did that, and then you left to do you left the Q&A stuff, right?
Yeah, left QA. I joined the company in Scotland when I came back from kind of traveling. As sort of lead QA, but with an agreement that I would start doing some design tasks, because I kind of knew that I wanted to be doing that. And then very quickly moved from junior designer to senior to lead in quite a short space of time. And that was kind of lead design, that's like game design and level design. And I think that's one of those things, especially at an indie studio, it's quite with bigger studios, it's there's a very clear distinction. You know, level designers block out the feeling and the the actual levels effectively. Whereas a game designer tends to be a bit more top down, kind of overseeing the entire, you know, the systems and how they interact and kind of lots of paperwork stuff. And to a certain extent in kind of smaller studios, often those roles are rolled into one.
So you do that, and then from there, I guess,
So I basically, it was about 5 years that that was at Cohort Studios up in Scotland. Like I say, working on a bunch of stuff, mostly for Sony, and then they shut. So everyone was jobless, and I set up my own company where I was kind of lead designer or, you know, design director or whatever. I mean, in none of our things, we put the credits are just our names in alphabetical order. But yeah, I mean, CEO and I guess design director or creative director or something like that.
So you moved up to that, or okay. So then after that shuts down, then from there you start Nosebleed Interactive.
Yeah. From there I started Nosebleed pretty much straight. Well, I kind of dossed about a little bit. My daughter was about 3 or 4 at the time. So I spent like 6 months kind of setting the company up, but also, you know, taking a chance to actually do some childcare. Which was, it was lovely because it was, you know, kind of nice and relaxed way of starting. I didn't have to worry too much. And it was just jumping in, going like, right, I'm going to start this company. Got a bunch of people on board and contract with Sony. And that was kind of the start of it.
I was going to ask, what's like for everyone listening, you know, if they wanted, if maybe they're starting or thinking about getting into indie, creating an indie studio or getting involved, what's kind of like the process of that? You know, did you, I'm assuming you create the company and then you have to gather your team, right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I think I maybe did it slightly differently than a lot of people that I've met, because what I've tended to see is like people who've recently graduated who already kind of have a bit of a team, or they already have some people in mind, and they go like, right, let's incorporate, let's make a company. And obviously I'm not going to say how to do that stuff, because every country differs, you know, we have different ways of starting and stuff. I mean, there's bureaucratic paperwork.
Yeah, but conceptually,
In terms of the way that I started was very much like, I want to do this. I need artist, coder. I also need someone senior to help bring, and I can't afford like, you know, seniors. So how am I going to do that? Well, I'll get some recent graduates, but I'll pair them off with some people who are, you know, who've been doing it a while. And they'll hopefully learn off each other, which very much they did, especially on the art side. The sort of the lead artist was learning just as much from the junior as the other way around, because the process has all changed and so on.
Yeah.
And so that, for me, that was a case of going out and looking, you know, going to universities, speaking to people. Like some of it was, you know, a bit of networking. But one thing actually, probably the biggest bit of advice that I could give to anyone starting up is how important networking is. Because up until that point, like I say, I'd never pitched anything in my life. I was hungover in a suit. But that networking part of it, I knew that I should do, but I hadn't quite realized how important it is to kind of grow those networks. And, you know, we're now 12 years old as a company, and, you know, we have repeat customers for kind of work for, like, obviously we do our own games, but we also do porting and work for hire for other people. So last year we did a port of The Room from PlayStation VR to PlayStation VR 2. We helped out Bossa Studios on their upcoming game. We, yeah, basically done a whole bunch of stuff on the side as well. And some of those things are brand new relationships, but some of them are relationships kind of 5 years in the making. Because, you know, you go to events like GDC or Gamescom or, you know, Develop in the UK or whatever. And you chat with these people, you have a beer with them or three, or, you know, you meet people, you have chats with them. They like you. There's nothing going on for 2 years. Third year comes along. It's like, hey, you know, you said you were good at this thing. We might have an opportunity. And it's growing that network of people that's the kind of a super important part of things that I knew it was a big deal, but I just didn't know quite how big a deal it would be.
Yeah, how much it would help you in the end. So you create Nosebleed, you go and recruit recent graduates, put together a team, and I'm assuming since you're the creative director at the time, was the idea of the games yours, and then you would just have your team build it. Is that right?
Yes, but also we're a small team, so I was kind of doing lots Hands of on. The creation. Yeah, very much. That's the bit that I love, That's why I make. That's mm-hmm. why I'm a game developer. It's not to tell people what to do. It's to fiddle with numbers and tweak stuff and mm-hmm. Set up animations. And I mean, in Arcade Paradise, just as an example, mm-hmm. so we've got a really good 3D art. Arcade Paradise was done with one artist. Like the whole game. So. Kind of quite a lot of asset packs and moving stuff around in there, changing stuff out. Like I played the demo of the new RoboCop game, and there's an arcade in there, and probably 60% of the arcade machines mm-hmm. look very similar to ours because they clearly bought the same asset pack. but our artist is not great at pixel art. Well, it's not that he's not great at it. I can't do 3D. Mm-hmm. He can. Therefore, I was I'll learn to do some pixel art. So Wood Gal Jr., which is the really old school one, that was mm-hmm. One of the first ones. And you can kind of see it's meant to be this kind of crappy 8-bit thing with bleep, 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 bleep.
Mm-hmm.
But my progression of learning how to do pixel art better and better, you can see that throughout, Wood Gal's Adventure, which is the Candy Crush type, with the... Mm-hmm. 2D, 3D sort of world map thing. Same character, but 16-bit now. And, the technology and people's artistry has moved on. But actually, that is also true because, I was here's a really simple game with really crappy graphics that's getting better. But also I was getting better at doing this sort of pixel art in the game. And so you can kind of see that progression through the game. But also it works just in terms of the narrative of the game.
Yeah. So you'd be the mastermind behind the idea of the game. Hey, here's the idea I have. Let's build it. And so what was your guys' first game that you guys made as a Nosebleed Interactive?
So it was called The Hungry Horde.
That's right. And that's the one you pitched to Sony, right?
Yeah, to Sony. So the effectively, it's a zombie game where you lead a horde of zombies and attack humans. And every time you kill a human, they join your horde. So think Pikmin with zombies. And a sort of a time limit because the government is trying to nuke you. The sort of thing on that was that you'd control the horde with the left stick, but then you could kind of you could use the right stick to kind of split them apart and kind of multitask, let's say. So you could be there was some light switch puzzles and stuff like that where you'd have to stand on one thing to open a door and then move the group through and then move the next group through and kind of dumb stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then our next game was a game called Vostok Inc., which is available on all platforms, including Nintendo Switch and PlayStation 4 and PC. And yeah.
Oh, I think we might have lost Dre for a second. Let's see if he pops back in.
Can you see me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I just don't have picture yet.
I think I am. I dropped boxes onto my camera input thing. Let me just quickly go to settings. I think it's easy.
No problem.
Camera again.
Yep, we got you back.
There we go. You see me and audio is all normal. Cool.
Yep, you're good.
about that. Yeah. No, On everything, you can buy it right now, and you should. always be selling.
I will definitely be picking that up.
that's a twin stick shooter, kind of a little Geometry Wars meets an mm-hmm. idle game like Cookie Clicker, that was kind of the one where we. It feels like we kind of nailed our identity with that one, just in terms of mm-hmm. the types of games that we want to make. The Hungry Horde definitely had a bit of that. There's arcade mm-hmm. games in it. I mean, Zombat 2 is an arcade game in Arcade Paradise, and Zombat is an arcade awesome. Game, an unlockable arcade game in the Hungry Horde. But yeah, so Vostok Inc. was like, it's this kind of idle game meets like the most frenetic genre of Twitch shooters there are. It's like bullet hell meets idle game. How does that work? And it works a treat, actually. It was we reviewed really well, like Greg Miller from Funny, what's it called? Oh, forgotten what Game Over Greggy. Loved it. And you know, there's it hit a nerve. It just didn't sell that many. I mean, it sold okay, but not, you know, I'm not driving a Ferrari or anything like that. And yeah, but it's that sort of addiction loop of like, I'll play for 5 more minutes and then 3 hours later you're still playing. And that's kind of one of those things that we're trying to build on that from the Hungry Horde into Vostok and then again in Arcade Paradise. So I'm hoping that sort of when people play Arcade Paradise, they're a little bit like, yeah, it's got something about it that stops you from putting it down.
It is. It's an addicting game. Well, before we continue, thank you, Castro Games. He said he's a high school esports coach and a lot of podcasts are useful. Keep up the good work. Thank you. That's what we're trying to do. I'm trying to bring, you know, information to people that are in the industry that kind of want to get in behind the scenes. So thank you. I appreciate that. But yeah, no, Arcade Paradise was awesome. I couldn't put it down. I just like, for some reason, it just kind of kept me in because there was always something that was just keeping you moving forward and keeping you unlocking things and keeping you excited about the game.
That's kind of our outlook on stuff. It started with the Hungry Horde, carried on in Vostok as well, and in Arcade we sort of probably pushed it to the next level just in terms of the types of things. Mm-hmm. But the kind of part of the thing was we wanted players to always have something new to do every 20 minutes, maximum half an hour, probably every quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. So, you know, once you get through the initial tutorial and so on, you'll be getting a new arcade machine every half hour at least.
So I'm assuming a big turning point for you guys was when you were able to get in front of Sony and pitch the Hungry Hordes, right?
Yeah. Well, when they signed, it was the turning point.
True.
So, up until that point.
And so you credit getting to that point from networking. So to get in front of the Sony execs, you had your network that you could reach out to. Is that
Well, kind of. So actually that was from the previous job. So I knew a couple of the I knew some producers there. In fact, junior producers. But they were like, hey, we'll get this in front of whomever. And it was like, oh, yeah, there's a competition going. You should enter it. Entered it and so, kind of won. Okay. But since then...
So you were
then,
pitching... Uh-huh.
Yeah, since then, the network... after that, it was like, all right, you know, this...
Once you've established that relationship.
Yeah, it's not just a cold, here's a pitch. It was like, okay, I need to talk to people that I want to pitch to beforehand so they know. I mean, to a certain extent, a lot of it is you knowing them as well. You know, there are companies where... there are companies where this happens, but you know, business relationships are relationships, right? You want to enjoy working with the people that you're working with. You don't want to go into it completely blind. And so if you're going into something with people that you've chatted to for years and, you know, have a good time with, you know, that's going to be a better working relationship than someone who you've never met, who's kind of just at the end of a Skype call, signing the check. You know, you want to be working with people closely so that they get buy-in on the project and all that sort of stuff as well.
So with other teams then, when they have, if they wanted to reach out to a brand like Sony, Nintendo, or Xbox, is there do they have anything specific that they need to do to reach out to them? Like, you know, is there like, anyone, let's say they don't have connection, if they don't have connections like you do, how would they get into that?
All the companies are slightly different. So like with Xbox in the UK, at least, to be fair, I think Xbox are like this in the US as well. Mm-hmm. Like back when we first worked with them, so it was after the Hungry Horde, but on Vostok, I knew that we wanted to be on lots of different platforms. I knew that we wanted to kind of start relationships outside of Sony. We wouldn't want to just have to rely on them. Mm-hmm. And so I basically hedged my bets. I was like, hey, we worked with Sony in the past. We would like to work with you now.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, cool. But he doesn't work there anymore. But there's a guy called Agostino Simonetta, who was head of ID at Xbox. So that's independent developers at Xbox. And I'd met him at shows and stuff and just introduced myself. And he's like, just get in touch on Twitter. Just chat, just send me a DM on Twitter. So some people are a bit like that. Nintendo are a little bit more difficult in Europe, I think, to speak to. It's that well, I say that. No, that's not even slightly true. No, I think that's unfair, actually. No, yeah, I'm talking nonsense. Same sort of thing, you know, going to shows, having a meeting, not necessarily pitching something straight away, but just having a meeting and saying, hey, we'd like to, you know, we're not trying to pitch to you a game. We're not trying to get money from you. More like we are interested in working with Sony. We'd like to know what's involved. And they all have business development folks as well, you know, so that they have people whose job it is to do networking, right? So that's finding out who those people are. And I think if you, it all starts with like local networks. If you're in a city where there's some game devs, go to the game dev meetups and get pally with them. And then they'll be like, oh, yeah, I know someone. I can do you an email intro. Or, oh, I know someone at this place. Or maybe this person will. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's that thing. It's kind of scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Be nice, basically. Just be nice to people. Yeah. And they'll be nice back. Okay. Right?
So you just reach out to them, build that network, build those relationships, and you should be able to get in front of people that you need to.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's like, I think maybe there's a bit of a fear when you've not been doing it for a while. It's like, oh, I'm not sure if, you know, I can build it for Steam because it's all automated. Oh, I don't know anyone at Sony. I don't know how I would pitch to Sony or, you know, I don't know the console holders. Oh, I don't know how I would get onto that because that seems a bit too big. It's like, well, do you know what? These platforms want content. They're hungry for it.
They need you as much as you need them.
I mean, if they don't have games, they don't have anything. And it's the same with publishers especially, you know. Publishers don't tend to have anything, you know. They don't have a console. Unless they own developers, they don't tend to, you know, they need us more than we need them to a certain extent these days.
And so developers can go straight to a platform as, you know, Sony, Nintendo, Xbox, or they could work with a publisher, right?
I mean, if you've got money, then and you have a knack for self promotion or you know, you have someone on the team who's really good at sort of marketing, PR and all that sort of stuff, then yeah, there's no reason that you couldn't self publish. And obviously you're gonna be taking the lion's share if that's the case. If you don't have the budget to build the game, then you might need to partner with either like a venture capital firm or something like that, or private investors, or a publisher. But in that instance, obviously you're not going to get as big a return, unless of course your publisher is absolutely amazing or even has a brand tied to them that sort of, let's be honest, something like, you know, a brand like Rockstar, they can put a Rockstar stamp on it and it'll sell no matter what it's like. To a certain extent, Devolver Digital, you know, Devolver Digital are a games brand as well as a publisher. You know, I'll buy a Devolver game just because it's, I'm like, what genre is it? I don't even look at who the developer is, which is a bit sad, especially as a developer. I should be like, who is this developer? But I'm like, I know it's, you know, it's a Devolver game, therefore,
yeah,
I'll probably like it. Chances are it's going to be high quality and up my street. So that in that instance, you know, the brand recognition is, you know, obviously you're getting the development budget and the marketing and so on, but also the fact that it is a Devolver game to a certain extent kind of helps, or, you know, a Raw Fury game or whichever genre and whichever sort of publisher that you're like, oh yeah, I like all of their games so far.
Sure. So you get on all the platforms. So like with your game that you just showed, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name again. Pull it up. I know it's on
Vostok
arcade. There it is. So you, as an indie developer, you can decide to go straight digital or physical, right? Or does it depend on your contracts?
I mean, all contracts are different, but yeah, these days it pays to do both.
Yeah.
I mean, it really
depends. Because I'm assuming physical, you're in stores in front of the people.
Yeah, digital, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's already been done, right? A lot of the times you're not, as a developer, we're not fronting any of the cash for
physical.
Know, for cost of sales or whatever it's called. That is already covered when they manufacture and so on. So, and I'll be honest, we're not doing like, I think this was this particular version with the gold, oh my God, with the guy in a pile of cash nude on the cover, that was limited to like 3,000 copies or something like that, I think. Whereas Arcade, also available physically via Limited Run Games or The Wired Shop, or I think you can get it on Amazon as well. That one wasn't a limited release because obviously it's going to sell more than than Vostok Inc. because it's a lot less niche. So yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's kind of like, in terms of creating the game, it's very straightforward, effectively.
Yeah. Okay.
One version is the same as the other to all intents and purposes.
Is it hard developing for different platforms, or is, like you said, or is it just pretty straightforward with all of them?
Oh, it's not hard. It's time consuming. So with Arcade Paradise, we did Switch, PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Xbox Series, Steam, GOG, Epic, Windows Store, Amazon Luna, and Google Stadia. And it's time consuming because each one, even though the game is fairly similar across all of them, each one's got its own little things that are a bit of a pain. It's got a lot easier these days, and especially we use a middleware called Unity, which means that stuff is straightforward, and we've got a bunch of plugins like Rewired is one that we use for input mapping and all that sort of stuff. But I tell you one thing, if you're an aspiring developer going multi-platform, always lead on your shittest platform, not shittest, on your least powerful platform. So Arcade, our lead platform on Arcade Paradise, despite the fact we're doing PS5 and Xbox Series early in the life cycle of those consoles, and obviously PC with all the bells and whistles, we led on Nintendo Switch because it's easy to make if you can make the game run nicely and look good on Switch, then you can add the bells and whistles for the other platforms. Whereas if you go, oh my God, it's the best looking PC game ever, and then you try and port down to Switch, you're going to have to cut corners and take stuff out, and it's just...
reduces the experience.
It's a compromised experience, right? Whereas the other way around, you can be like, oh, we could add this, oh, we could add that. Nice little things. You can have fun that way, whereas it's a massive ball ache and a pain going the opposite way. In actual fact, there's a bit of an anecdote with Arcade on Switch, which is that we we have on the Switch version a performance mode and a graphics mode, because we were trying to go for 60 frames a second, but we wanted the nice graphics as an option. But we optimized it so well that effectively the performance mode is redundant because the graphics mode, the one with all the pretty, with all the post effects and stuff, already renders at 60 frames a second almost everywhere. So it's like, all right, fair enough. Well, that's a freebie. So we were quite happy with, by the time we kind of launched, it was like, oh, well, we could take this out, but let's just leave it in if you want to go 1080p on big screen.
Yeah, true. So as a game, indie game developer, then for you guys, how does, I guess, what is when you, from conception to end to when it's on the shelf, what does it look like for a new game development? Long process, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, so prototyping is the really fun bit. There's a really good anecdote, and that is like the first 80% of the game takes the first 20% of the time to make, and the last 20% of the game takes the rest of the 80% of the time to make. So getting to the point where you're like, Arcade Paradise, for example, we've got like 30, whatever, 40 something now, I guess, arcade machines and this whole game loop with like a story and all that sort of stuff. Getting it to the point where we had most of the games and the core loop and all that sort of stuff was pretty fast. Oh, in fact, even better example is Vostok. So the prototype for Vostok was really similar to the final game. And it took us maybe 3-4 weeks to make that first, like, you know, you can play the game. It feels good. We know exactly what the game is. And then 2.5 years was polish and tweaking and adding little bits and bobs and getting it ported to all the consoles and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of, yeah, iterating and ideation. Well, one thing I've learned is to get someone on board who's good at planning, because I am not. my personality type is very sort of here, there, and everywhere.
Sure.
A bit like the game, you know, you kind of easily distracted. But I think that a lot of that's kind of come from my personality anyway. Like, arcade is a game that I actually play for fun, even now, despite having worked on it for
years.
A long time now.
So, I mean, how does it feel when you see your game on a shelf? Is it like...
Oh, it's cool. Exciting. Yeah, it's still really cool. It's really fun. It feels really nice. Actually, so I was saying earlier on that I quit my job and went traveling because my wife was doing a PhD and was doing field work abroad. So one of the places we went to like New Zealand for about 6 months, 7 months, and I got a job in electronics boutique out there. Guy that interviewed me was kind of weirdly shy chatting with me. I mean, he was interviewing me. He was the manager of the shop. I think he was a little bit younger than me. In the McDonald's in the shopping mall that we're in. And then at the end, he's like, well, you've got the job. And I was like, oh, sweet. Awesome. And then he was like, but like your CV, you know, it says you used to be a tester on games and stuff. Like, if I get one of the games, is your name going to be in the credits? Basically, I was like, yeah, sure. So we went into the shop and got the PS2 version of, I think it was SRS Street Racing Syndicate, and like there was like, you know, QA team, and there was my name, and basically all the regulars that went into the shop when we were both on a shift together, he'd be like, oh, look, this guy worked on this game. Look, here's his name. And I was like, I felt like a bit of a rock star despite it being the least glamorous thing possible.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, that's great. I mean, that's awesome. I'm sure that was some great information for all of our listeners. So now where you guys are at, what do you guys have planned for the future? You know, you guys have established yourselves, right? Yeah. You guys have a nice team. You have good games out right now. What's kind of the roadmap for 24 for you guys? Or anything coming up?
So just before Christmas, I think it was the 6th of December, we announced... We announced that Arcade Paradise VR is coming.
Oh, cool.
To Meta Quest 2 and 3. So I'm not going to talk
about
that.
That'll be a fun experience.
Very much. Do you know what? It's quite transformative, actually. It's like it feels... So with Arcade, with Arcade Paradise, we really wanted to make the players feel like present in that world. You know, we want to fit you. It was about being in the 90s in a shitty job that you hate, with the prospect of having this cool job that you love in the background. You know, it's like that sort of aspirational thing. And, you know, we spent a lot of effort trying to make it really feel quite authentic and feel like you're there. Like I was telling you earlier on about the, you know, the screens, everything was rendered to the screen rather than, you know, to the CRT TVs and all that sort of stuff. Playing it in VR really, really does transport you. Like it feels so kind of weirdly authentic. And some of the activity, you know, again, I don't want to talk too much because we've got some, basically, sure. I'll get told off by the publisher's marketing team, but like the sort of the activities, you know, like stuff in Arcade Paradise where, you know, you would press a button to do something physical, like putting washing in a washing machine, you know, we would simulate something. Mm-hmm. We don't have to do that in VR. We can actually physically do that stuff. So cleaning the toilet doesn't feel like a lock-picking game. It feels like cleaning the toilet. Throwing the trash out doesn't feel like a golf swing meter. It feels like you're physically throwing trash in. And it's like, it's those things that have really, it feels really at home in VR.
That's great. So are you guys going to be developing more stuff for VR?
We've done a whole bunch of VR games in the past for other people. This is our first VR title of our own, but we've had people working on Sniper Elite in VR. We've had people working on, what's it called? Budget Cuts, a port of that. I think it was a PS4 port we had someone working on. Mm-hmm. Like I say, The Room, the port of The Room to PSVR 2. We've done a whole, and some non-games commercial stuff as well. So we're familiar with VR, and obviously arcade fits nicely. But so there's that, and then we also have starting soon another project that I can't talk about that's going to be super duper exciting, and we're pitching the next sort of big nosebleed game. At GDC basically is where we're going to start pitching it, so that's like 3 months. So we're kind of basically starting work yesterday, because that's when we were back in the office on a prototype for that, which we've got 2 and a bit months to do, whilst also going into submission on APVR.
Well, that's exciting. I'm excited because Arcade Paradise, that would be an awesome game in VR. I think everyone should check it out. If you haven't played Arcade Paradise, play it. It's on all the platforms, like you said right now. It's a great game. If you love nostalgia and just being engaged, that was such a fun game. There it is. Online or digital.
Yeah, in store, online, digital. It's on Game Pass still at the moment, and it might still be on Humble Choice. I'm not sure. But it's always on sale and all that sort of stuff. And you get a lot of game for your buck.
Yeah, it's an awesome game. Before we start wrapping up, anything kind of you had anything you want to tell the followers, listeners, any kind of insights or any special kind of pieces of information that you've learned throughout your career?
Be nice to people. Yeah. That's a big one. Do plenty of networking. If you are a designer or a coder looking to do stuff, check out Juice It or Lose It. Just YouTube, just Google Juice It or Lose It and The Art of Screen Shake, two really important videos for just bang for buck stuff in terms of like basically making the screen shake, making games feel nice. What else? You could follow us on Twitter if you like, @NosebleedGames.
Yeah, plug in all your socials so everyone can reach out to you and follow you, keep up to date.
Yeah, @NosebleedGames. It's actually Nosebleed Interactive is the company, obviously. I think we've got a Facebook one as well, but I can't remember. It's probably Nosebleed Interactive on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I think we do have threads mm-hmm. as well. Although I think I've posted on there once and I just see like occasionally people start following and I'm like, eventually I'll hook something up so it auto-posts. But we don't spam you. I think we're going to open we're probably going to open a public Discord channel at some
point. That's a good
idea. Soon. Mm-hmm. Play Arcade Paradise and Vostok Inc.
Yes.
And follow us and
yeah.
be nice. Just be nice to people. That's the main one. I mean, that's just a life lesson, but as a business thing as well, just be nice to people. Like,
This is benefit nice everyone.
And, yeah. Be nice to people. People are nice to you. And, people make games it's a business and it's there to make money, but I think most people that are making games are making it for the love of the craft and the love of games. You know, it's all about it's all about that sort of enjoyment. And if you don't, if you're starting a company, make sure it's somewhere that people want to work and keep working at, keeping it a place that people want to work. Because you're not going to be paying as much as Ubisoft and Activision and so on. So how else can you benefit them? Well, by making it somewhere that they want to work, where they have decision making. They're not a little cog in a big machine. They're a big cog in a little machine.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, before I wrap up, let everyone know. Let me know, what are your top three favorite games of all times?
Oh no, I can't. It's a top 20 I could do. Top three is right. I don't want to be held on this one because it's just too sure. It changes well, too much.
But we'll have you back on the future, so you can always change it.
Yeah, yeah. I think Shenmue has to be in there because that was okay. That was quite transformative. Mm-hmm. Ocarina of Time probably classic. Has to be in there. Oh, what are we going to go with third one? Because as soon as I say it, there's going to be something else that I'm like, oh, why didn't I say that one? No, no. Well, that's it. I'm like, I'm Metal Gear Solid 3, but no. But yeah, I don't. Let's leave the last one, the third one, and these are in no order, as a blank slate. Because there are so many. Okay. I mean, I'm playing Cyberpunk 2077, finally, at the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I played a ton of Modern Warfare 2, like an absolute, no, in fact, Modern Warfare, sorry, the mm-hmm. remake, played an absolute ton of that recently. I don't know if I actually like it, though. I was more a slave to it. You should have asked the influences on Arcade Paradise. That would have been an easier question, because there's some obvious ones, obviously, you know, mm-hmm. Pac-Man, GTA, yada yada. That's the mm-hmm. like the obvious ones that are the games. But like one of the big ones early doors was Stardew Valley, just in terms of the game mm-hmm. loop and that like the saving system. Yeah, you end the day to save the game, mm-hmm. but then you've probably got something new being delivered. So you're like, oh, I'll just play for 5 more minutes to see what the new thing is. And you play for 5 more minutes, and that's already a half a day. So you're like, well, I might as well finish my day. And then you've got something new, and so you're kept in that loop. That was a genius thing. Obviously, Shenmue and Yakuza are a huge influence on Arcade Paradise, just in terms of like the world building and the fact that we wanted to create something that felt like a big open world game. Mm-hmm. In terms of the variety of things that you can do and so on, but compact it into like 2 rooms basically.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of feels a bit like one of those open world games where you've got a whole bunch of different things to do,
mm-hmm.
but it's in a laundromat and an arcade and a bus stop. That's the entire world. So yeah, I mean, I'd like to expand out, let's say, mm-hmm. not necessarily with the arcade theme, but kind of, I see the next Nosebleed game being kind of it's going to be similar in terms of the game feel, but mm-hmm. hopefully bigger. So yeah, there's 2 influences.
Okay. And the last question real quick. How'd you come up with Nosebleed?
So there's when I started the company, like this is like 12 years ago, there's this like not fashion, but in the UK games companies, had this like, it was a phase where everyone was like, you know, an animal, and a verb and an animal, or like a verb, like an animal and a color, or a fruit and a color. And it was just like, you know, giggling donkey, or like blue squid, or yellow cherry digital, or whatever. And it was just, there were just so many of them that it was like, we actually had a spreadsheet of like, the bad names and a look at a thing where you know the full name, but a thing where you could just hit a button and it would like randomly jumble them up and it'd be like, well, these are all terrible. So we wanted something just a bit more edgy that had like multiple connotations and just just kind of cool and memorable.
Yeah, it's definitely edgier than everything else out there.
Yeah, the other thing was so I was a big fan of Wipeout 2097. Mm-hmm. On the original PlayStation, and there was a bit of poster art for that, and I didn't realize it, but I've known the guy who came up with the marketing campaign for that game for years. He's like a close friend, and I didn't realize he worked at Sony at the time and was in charge of that. I was like, when he told me we were eating a curry, I was like, are you kidding me? I was like properly in awe. I was like, our company logo is basically based on a poster that you directed. And he's like, really? I was like, yeah, mate, look. So yeah, big shout out to Gary on that one. But yeah, that was it.
That's cool. That's the reason. Just wondering
because it just wanted to not be giggling donkey or blue. Yeah.
Sure, I got you. Well, Dre, we will definitely have to have you back on later this year, kind of follow up and see what Nosebleed's getting into, what they got releasing, kind of development on stuff. So if you'd like to come back on, I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe a little retrospective on Arcade Paradise VR.
Yep, exactly. But yeah, we'll wrap it up. We're hitting the hour mark. But thank you so much for hopping on. I really appreciate you taking the time to come out, tell our viewers a little bit about yourself, background, your kind of your history, and a little bit into the Nosebleed Interactive development.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. So this will go live. You can stay on though. We will end this here. Thank you everyone for listening. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me or Dre through his socials. Sound good?
Cheers. All right. Yeah, perfect.